From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, our Real Talk series with David Pate continues with a look at racial disparities in Dane County. Later, Gene Creighton counts down the top astronomy stories of 2013, like exciting finds on Mars.
It had all the building blocks of life as we know it. So we found sulfur, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and carbon in this rock on Mars.
Our dining contributor offers some ideas for eating out over the holidays, including one spot in Pewaukee.
It feels like this time of year, you know, the cold in the air, the snow, the pine trees, everything sort of, all of it sort of feels like that kind of food that you might want to eat. That's sort of along those lines of the holiday feel.
And an essayist tells the story of his first deer hunt. Lake Effect is next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Over the last couple of months and in the weeks going forward, WUWM has been investigating Wisconsin's high rate of incarceration among African-American men. The state boasts the highest rate in the nation, and in Milwaukee County, more than half of African-American men in their 30s have served time in state prison. A recent study out of Dane County shows that area is also contributing to the state's high rate of incarceration of blacks, but it also reveals other profound racial disparities in child welfare, education, income, and job opportunities. The study was conducted by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families Race to Equity Project. Erica Nelson is the project director. Nelson and the project was introduced to us by David Pate, our Real Talk contributor, who brings us data and community-driven conversations about race and gender disparities. Pate joined Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce in the studio, Nelson by phone, and Nelson started by offering an overview.
Dane County, like Milwaukee County, has high disparities for African Americans generally and their involvement in the criminal justice system. So, for example, in 2012, African American adults, not broken down by gender, were 8 times more likely than their white counterparts to be arrested. And similarly, with respect to new prison placement rates in Dane County in 2012, African Americans were 15 times more likely to be placed in prison than whites.
Erica, that number is really, really very high. And the one thing I have to admit that even as someone who lives in Madison, this issue of policing is something that I feel as an African-American male quite high. And I have to admit, when I read your report, I kept saying to myself, it can't be this bad. But I knew it was because I tell my own son how
right.
He has to take care of himself when he's driving his car, when he's walking somewhere, because several of his friends have been stopped by the police. How has the city responded to your report around this issue of the incarceration rates of black males?
Well, I think what's interesting is that with respect to this individual indicator or this factor, and that is African-American male incarceration rate, I think there's been less of a sort of specific response to that indicator,
mm-hmm.
And there's been more of a response with respect to all the numbers, the 40-plus measures that we've collected looking or comparing African-Americans to whites. I think that given your comment about the state of Wisconsin being the highest in terms of African-American male incarceration, Dane County is contributing to that statistic. And I think that much of the focus that we've put on in the report has been on thinking that the adult criminal justice system is sort of the end of the line, and that there are many drivers in our community here in Dane County and in the African American community in particular that is sort of pushing these high disparity rates. I mean, we have high disparity rates in juvenile justice, and we have high disparity rates in other deep end systems like child welfare, for example.
Well, let's get into some of these factors, Erica and David. One of the interesting notes that's made in this report is that there's this assumed relatively high standard of living in Dane County, but that experience, as Erica just pointed out, really doesn't seem to extend to most black families there. So what exactly is going on? What are some of these factors that you've found, Erica, that are indicating this vast disparity between the black and white experience in Dane County?
Yeah, and I think that is it exactly, is that there's a difference in lived experience between African Americans and whites, not all, but for the most part, a majority. And if I may just sort of back up a second, when we were thinking about collecting all these numbers, we had a hypothesis about what we would find. And we thought there would be high disparities between whites and African Americans, because in particular because we were aware of some juvenile justice and criminal justice, adult criminal justice disparities that already existed. And the reason we thought they'd be high is because it seemed to us that whites, in terms of their quality of living and their well-being, were doing better on average than whites across the country, and that African Americans were doing on par or on average with other African Americans in the state or in the nation as a whole. And when we started to get into the research and look at the individual indicators, we kept on finding over and over that, in fact, African Americans here in Dane County, on average, were doing worse than their counterparts in other major cities in the United States. And that was really surprising, and that is why the county has some of the highest disparity rates in terms of well-being between African Americans and whites in, you know, urban, rural, north, or south throughout the nation. And I think the drivers behind these high disparities are, one is, you know, a history, a long history of discrimination, of slavery, of institutional and structural racism that has had the effect of disadvantaging African Americans both here in Dane County but also across the nation as a whole. And then there are some local factors here in the county that have also been contributing. What we're terming a labor market mismatch, in other words, mm-hmm. where there is high unemployment among African Americans at about 25% compared to about, I think, 5% for whites.
Mm-hmm.
The economy here is one that it requires high technology skill sets and high credentials. And the economy is also filled with college students, predominantly white college students, who are occupying, in order to put themselves through school, a fair number of jobs that would otherwise be occupied with those that have less education, maybe only a high school degree, or have less or fewer networks to get jobs. For example, we have very few African American businesses. So I think that there is a mismatch in terms of the workforce that is seeking work and the positions that are available to them in terms of how people view what is credentialed, what is experienced in that respect.
So then that's resulting in this statistic that you've reported, that black adults in Dane County are 5.5 times more likely to be jobless than their
yeah.
white counterparts. And that is so much higher than the national disparity rate, which is only, and I say that with air quotes, only twice as much.
Yeah.
How does that affect, and David, this is something we've talked about a
exactly.
lot, wealth and assets?
I think, I mean, obviously, if you're unemployed or also underemployed, in other words, you're not getting opportunities to advance, or you're just receiving minimum wage but trying to support a family of four, I think this has implications, obviously, in terms of median household income, and it has implications in terms of child poverty.
Right. In the report, you highlighted this high disparity among child poverty. It's 13-1. For a disparity ratio between black and white children in Dane County.
So there's about 5,000 African-American children in poverty in the county, but there's only about 9,000 children total.
The one thing I wanted to say, too, that I thought was interesting, the issue of social networks is a big thing
mm-hmm.
that people just do not have in the city of Madison. I often think of where black people live who are migrating from Chicago
mm-hmm.
or another place to live there. I think of the places in Madison as refugee camps. And that's such an interesting visual to me, only because they're in this space where there's no store, there's
right.
there's nothing. There's just a living space. And I think that doesn't allow for them to be part of the community.
Right.
They are just this isolated group of people in this refugee area.
In terms of going back to thinking about some of the drivers or the causes behind these great degree of disparities, this is something that we're sort of constantly bringing up, and that's sort of this neighborhood isolation or lack of neighborhood connections. So we've been talking about sort of enclaves, essentially, where there is a few block radius of African American families that are surrounded by middle class white homes. And in these neighborhoods or enclaves, rather, I mean, there are no neighborhood institutions that support families in the same sense that they would be in a bigger neighborhood in a bigger urban environment like Harlem or the South Side of Chicago. So the 15-year-old who wants to get his first break at a job can't go to the neighborhood store and say, hey, John, would you give me a break here and give me some summer employment so I can add it to my resume? And on top of that, there's not necessarily transportation that goes directly to these neighborhoods. So this sort of blending or connection in terms of people being able to connect with each other or being able to connect with larger community organizations or even places of employment.
Yeah. And also, I didn't mean to cut you off, but even thinking about that juvenile justice issue, when you think about having your first job as a teenager, that sets your standard for the rest of your life. There's research that shows if you have when you have a job at the age of 14, 15, or 16, that really sets your way for employment, your history of employment. And if I think about my own kids again here, both of my kids were able to get a job because of my social networks, and they were able to work in a restaurant. If you look at any restaurant, any department store in Madison, there are no black or brown children working in any of those stores or restaurants. And I'm always amazed by that. Where in Milwaukee, I can at least see that. I feel like we're part of the environment. Not saying Milwaukee's people are doing better. I mean, they are doing better around disparities. But there's still the opportunity for them to get an opportunity to be in the world of work and to have that experience of what it means to get a paycheck.
Are there opportunities when it comes to education for these children in Dane County?
Well, I think that there are educational opportunities in the sense that there are a vast number of public schools that serve the children. However, there are high disparities in terms of educational opportunities or achievement. For instance, if you look at things like third grade reading, and third grade reading is one of the most important indicators for future academic success. I think it was in 2012, 86% of African American children in third grade were not proficient in reading. And I think about something like 47% of white children were not proficient. And my saying is that you know, learn to read to the third grade, and then after the third grade, you read to learn. And if you're not there, if you're not on the right pace in the third grade, you're constantly playing a catch-up game, which leads to a level of disconnection from your academic experience. There's also high disparities with respect to chronic absences, and there's also disparities for suspension or expulsion for sort of discretionary reasons. In other words, there's a big gray area of what other things you can get suspended for, like getting in a fight or yelling at a teacher. And if you look at a comparison between African American youth and whites, you know, you're 15 times more likely to have a suspension or an expulsion that involves an African-American kid than you are a white, which means that they're now not in school or not participating or fully more disconnected, and their likelihood of then being involved in the juvenile justice system increases. So even the numbers that you see in juvenile justice, adult criminal justice, and child welfare, from my perspective, really mirror or reflect the disparities in economic well-being and educational opportunity.
Are we creating, and I know that this is a controversial concept, but I want to ask the question, are we creating a school-to-prison pipeline when we're not addressing these kinds of disparities at their source?
Well, I think we're creating I don't know if it's all the time across the board it's a pipeline to prison, but it certainly is a pipeline to, you know, less productivity, less involvement in the community, and diminishment in terms of opportunities for anything, for employment, for stable housing, for looking at post-secondary education. And I think that, you know, not every one of these kids is going to end up necessarily in prison, but their challenges and the obstacles that they face increase with each disadvantage.
Yeah, and I think, too, what you're saying is like one of the things I heard President Obama say, and I've also heard Pope Francis say in a broader way, is that we're challenging the basic bargain that we give to people that in America, for example, if you work hard, you should be able to take care of your family. If you work hard, you should be able to accumulate some kind of asset and wealth to take care of yourself. But however, in the Dane County community, for black and brown people, I don't see that bargain being upheld. Like, they are now at a place where they're struggling.
I mean, I think what you've just said is sort of one of the things that we talk about with respect in the report about sort of the racialization of disadvantage, in which Dane County is a place, because of all these disparities and these variety of well-being indicators, where poverty and poor outcomes have an exceptionally strong correlation with race and color. In other words, you can't extract or say this has everything to do with poverty and has nothing to do with race. And because there's sort of this high correlation, because there's a high degree of African-American families that are poor and they're African-American, it creates this pattern or potential to reinforce stereotypes, you know, and different expectations based on color.
Milwaukee always has this reputation of being the most segregated, the most racially divided community. How do we take these factors and compare the experience of blacks in Dane County and Milwaukee?
In some ways, the experience is going to be the same. Disproportionately, African Americans are experiencing disparities in education and employment, right? And child poverty for African Americans in Milwaukee County is a little bit less, but it's at like 53% for African American children, as opposed to around 56 or 57 for black children here in Dane County. So there are some similarities in terms of the experience, I imagine. Yes, there's division between African Americans and whites in Milwaukee, and it is one considered or mentioned as one of the most segregated cities. But those African American neighborhoods have their own social networks and have pockets of thriving folks and people that are providing connections, or a person who has a job who then gives someone the opportunity.
Yeah, I would definitely say that if you look at the indicators of employment and education and poverty. Now, Milwaukee as a city has been in the top 10 around poverty. Mm-hmm. Madison hasn't, so you would expect Madison to have better outcomes, and I definitely agree with you. And there has been a targeted push to get more men employed or more people employed in Milwaukee. So there are those jobs that are service industry jobs.
Yeah.
You will see black and brown people working in them. You won't see that in Madison.
The thinking going forward has to be how we retool or construct policies, both on a local level and a state level and a national level, to increase those opportunities for particularly families and children of color. So, I mean, I hope that's one of the things that comes out of this report.
Well, Erica, thank you so much again. And David Pate as well. Thank you so much for this Real Talk conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Erica Nelson is the project director of the Race to Equity Project by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families. David Pate is our Real Talk contributor, as well as an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UWM. He's the founder of the Center for Family Policy and Practice as well. Keep listening when we return. 2013 was a big year in astronomy. We'll find out why in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. Last week on the show, we spoke with Discover Magazine editor Steve George about the magazine's picks for the most important science stories of 2013. At the top of the list was discoveries made on the planet Mars. And so it should be no surprise that our astronomy contributor, Jean Creighton, also includes Mars on her list of top astronomical stories of the past 12 months. She talked with Bonnie North and explained why.
Curiosity is the latest rover that has landed on Mars. By the way, there's another spacecraft on its way to Mars now. Curiosity landed very successfully in August of 2012, and it was sometime in February that its instruments pierced a hole about 2.5 inches in a rock, and it was designed to have all these analytical instruments on board so they could take that little piece of debris from Mars and analyze it chemically. And we found that not only was Mars a liquid environment, but also more interestingly is that the water was not acidic, not too alkaline, or too salty. And this is significant because although we all agree now there's been plenty of data suggesting that there was lots of water on Mars and for long periods of time, and liquid water, I mean, we weren't quite sure whether there would be enough salt in the water to make it impractical for life to flourish. So it turns out that Mars has been, at least, I should say, a very promising place for life. Furthermore, it had all the building blocks of life as we know it. So we found sulfur, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and carbon in this rock on Mars. I don't think the suggestion is that there's life or that there has been, at least not based on this data, but I think the suggestion is that all the building blocks were there. Whether the opportunity arose, we don't know yet. I mean, this is a small sample. How could we possibly exclude that there were some bacteria, for example, on Mars? But for now, we just have the suggestion that it was a friendly place to life at some point.
Which is very cool. And of itself.
And frankly, I prefer that we don't have terrible monsters emerging from Mars.
Yes, me too. But we did have, this is the second thing on our list, summing up the year in astronomy, there was a fireball in Russia that was pretty scary. Talk about scary things coming from outer space.
It was, which is a nice segue, yes. This was, interestingly enough, the same day that we expected a pretty close visit from an asteroid. These two events turned out to be utterly unconnected. The fireball in Russia turned out to be between 55 and 59 feet. It glowed for 35 seconds, which is an eternity. That's a very long time to see a meteor. They're called fireballs when they're at least the brightness of a planet, by the way. And it exploded about 14 miles above sea level. Thankfully, no, there were no fatalities, but 1,700 people were injured and 7,000 buildings were damaged. Most of these buildings were not damaged by direct hits from debris, as you might expect, but of the compressed air.
I was going to say the concussion. Yes.
Yeah, so the air got compressed, so that basically creates a shock and it blows out windows. 7,000 buildings were damaged. Perhaps what makes this event deserving to be in the five top was that it catapulted some discussion about, well, things like this could happen at any moment, especially if you're looking from objects that are too close to the sun that our regular satellites wouldn't see. So now people are talking about other ways of detecting such objects and learning more about asteroids, the kinds of objects that are most likely generating these. So it's been decided that in 2016, OSIRIS-REx is going to go to an asteroid and return a sample in 2023. Furthermore, there's been this huge advertising for ideas, basically call for ideas to see how could we capture an asteroid and move it.
Oh, so in other words, to prevent it from hitting us.
Yeah, if something was coming too close, what could we do about that? And that, I think, might be a very exciting segue to things to come and learn more about these asteroids and what we could do if things went south for us.
Going back out into space now is number three, which is Voyager 1. And my understanding is that it's in interstellar space now, right? What does that mean?
In different places, you'd hear the news item differently. But let's just remind ourselves that Voyager 1 was a spacecraft that left the Earth, I think, in 1977. So they were built to last. And they was going to do the grand voyage of the solar system. It would get to Jupiter and Saturn, and then it would fly out of the plane of the solar system and keep going for as long as possible. At the moment, it looks like it has enough battery, as it were, enough energy to continue to send transmissions until 2020 that would be strong enough for us to be able to detect. And the idea was that this is going to become the object that people have made that's gone farthest from Earth. So it is now at approximately 126 astronomical units, which means it is 126 times farther than the distance between the Earth and the Sun. Why it got into the news was that The sun creates a bubble around the whole solar system, basically. And that's because there's a strong magnetic field and there's also a lot of radiation that basically washes away all the particles, the charged particles and the neutral particles that would be streaming through the what we call interstellar space. So we have a protection bubble thanks to the sun. It turns out that Voyager 1 has traveled far enough that we're outside of that highly protective bubble, and now we can measure the kind of concentrations of those interstellar particles that you would expect beyond that, beyond what we call the heliopause.
To use Star Trek parlance, it's gone beyond the shields.
Yes, it's gone beyond the shields. But I should point out, though, that some headlines where it left the solar system, which isn't quite right, because the solar system is considerably larger if we consider that the Oort cloud, we've talked about this together before, that is the very distant sphere of frozen materials that give birth to comets eventually, that would be 10,000 astronomical units away. And that would be a better definition of what the edge of the solar system is. In other words, what we consider our solar system is the part of space that's mostly influenced by the gravity of the sun. If you go past the Oort cloud a bit, well, then you're as likely as not to be attracted to the other star next to us.
Right.
I love this romantic idea that this is as far as something that we've touched, how far it's gone.
Well, that takes us to number four on the list, which is something that actually looks at things that are well beyond our solar system, which is exoplanets. And that's the Kepler telescope, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on with that? I know it sent us a lot of wonderful data.
It had a major press release in January of 2013. And the current candidate number is approximately 3,500. 3,500 exoplanets, Bonnie. Who would have thought that 20 years ago? It was such a dream. This spacecraft launched in March of 2009, and it has looked for 4 years at 160,000 stars. And the point was that if a planet is accompanying that star that we're looking at, then the brightness of the star is going to change as the planet comes in front of it. Now, it turns out that there are many reasons why the brightness of a star might change. Maybe it's a planet. Maybe it has some sunspots or the equivalent of. Maybe it has some flares or other things are going on. So we need at least three what we call transits of the planet in front of the sun and measure those dips. So it turns out that some stars are much naughtier than the sun, and we need many more than three to do that. So we learned something about stars in addition to learning about planets around other solar systems. We found now, I think the count is over 300 that are similar in size with the Earth. That doesn't mean that we found 300 Earths, because, of course, they need decent temperatures, they need an atmosphere, they need lots of things. But the fact that we have so much raw material to work with, and then we can zoom in on those worlds with other instruments and understand a little better their properties, is, I think, a triumph. Not to be lessened by the fact that after 4 years, its third gyroscope, so what helped the telescope point accurately to its targets, failed, which was past the warranty, so we can't really complain. But it seems like NASA has found a way of using the telescope in any case. So the worst case scenario is that we can't get as good data as we have, but we still have at least a year's worth of data to sift through. So the discoveries have certainly not ended. But it looks like we might even be able to continue observing with this marvelous spacecraft.
And that brings us to number five on your top five list from 2013. We've gotten new data. We're back to more discovery.
We are. I'm particularly fond of cosmology because that whole field, in some ways, from an observational point of view, came into its own within my career. I'm talking about a spacecraft called Planck that's observing in microwaves. So that is part of the light, part of the electromagnetic spectrum that has wavelengths that are longer than what we can see with our eyes. This light, the microwave background that we see, so if you look in any direction of the sky with a microwave telescope, you will see there's a huge band that follows the Milky Way. But if you set that aside, every other place has a low-grade background that's sitting at about 3 degrees Kelvin. That's 3 degrees above absolute zero. We discovered this in 1967. Penzias and Wilson picked up a Nobel Prize for this observation. But people thought, where is this coming from? Eventually, we got the theorists lined up with the observations, and we realized that this had been predicted. The Big Bang Theory predicts that at about 400,000 years after the beginning of time, T equals zero, I call dramatically, after 400,000 years, light and matter separate, go their separate ways. Before then, the universe was so hot that light was absorbed, re-emitted so quickly that it really didn't have any freedom to go anywhere. But at about 400,000 years, light finally was free to move, and that's the light from that part of the universe, that early time in the universe, that's almost 13 billion years ago now, that's the light that we see. So we actually are bathed in the light from the Big Bang.
From the beginning of time.
Almost the beginning. Almost, to be precise. Almost, yeah. Not quite. So there has been a series of instruments, and each time that a complete survey is done, more details come through. So we still, for example, know that the age of the universe is approximately 13.8. I'm not going to quote more decimal places. That's good enough. 13.8 billions of years. That the universe is made of approximately 5% of what we call regular matter. So that would be you and me, stars, galaxies. 27% what we call dark matter. So that is material that we can't directly see, but we can feel its gravitational effects. And then, of course, there's the lovely, mysterious 68%, that is most of the universe, that we call fondly dark energy. We don't know necessarily the nature of it yet, but we do know that it's forcing the universe to accelerate in its expansion.
And all of that
came to fruition this year. So they made an announcement this fall. In addition to kind of fine-tuning some of the observations that we had, it also is poised to look at the radiation from a different point of view. I mean, this light that I've described has been studied and squeezed for all it's worth because it really contains so much information about the beginning of the universe and its future. But in addition, it looks like if you look at the modes of the light, so the light would appear to vibrate in two different modes. They're both kind of tricky to see. We call this polarization. One type of polarization that they're poised to measure could give us real information even before that decoupling, that 400,000 years, when the universe was so young, so less than a few minutes old, we would have what we call inflation, when the universe grew from smaller than the size of an atom to a size of a cherry. And this inflation was such a dramatic, one of the most dramatic events in the universe, we would love to get a better handle on how that worked exactly. So as you can imagine, everybody's drooling over where that might lead us.
Well, and of course, that means for us in our conversations next year and the year beyond and whatever, we'll have plenty to talk about.
We always do.
We always do. Jean, have a wonderful holiday and new year, and we'll catch you in January.
Thank you very much.
Jean Creighton is director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium at UW-Milwaukee and our regular astronomy contributor. She talked with Bonnie North about her picks for the top astronomy stories of 2013. Another break now, and then some can't-miss ideas for eating out in and near Milwaukee over the holidays. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. More of Lake Effect, I'm Mitch Tyke. Many of us will have friends or relatives in town for the holidays, and even if your Christmas plans call for a fancy meal at home, you might be looking for a special place to take visitors for a meal over the holidays. But the places you take your friends may or may not be the places you go with your parents. Lake Effect Dining contributor Ann Christensen tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about her variety of favorites.
I always want to take people to Sanford, but you see, I want to go to Sanford all the time. So I'm going to take them someplace where I want to go.
Okay.
I want to go to Sanford because that is the one place that I think you can find, you know, really five-star type food. Like, you're going to put it – I could put it up against some place in Chicago that people are clamoring to go to that would take, like, 5 months to get a reservation. So I'd go to Sanford.
Okay.
And, you know, just have a really civilized and proper dining experience.
All right.
No, I feel like it's very zen in there. It's quiet. It's, you know, you kind of feel like no elbows on the table. So it would be just a really kind of a beautiful dining experience. I'd also take them to Hinterland because I think it's really fun to see what those guys are doing with all their charcuteries that made in-house, their sausages. There's always game and fish. Certain nights of the week, they've got, you know, pho and tacos and handmade gyros, which I think a lot of people sort of don't realize that they do that in the bar. That would be just a fun place to go and have a great wintry cocktail. I would also say Ardent, which is a new restaurant on Farwell, where the chef used to be at Umami Moto. He opened his own place, and it's a very small menu, but it's all things. I mean, he's, you know, has a short rib dish on the menu right now, and it comes from this cow that is from his dad's farm in Sparta. You know, he's got a milk course on the menu that has, you know, handmade butter and cheese, and then there's a roll made with butter, and it all comes from the same cow. So, I mean, it's just really specific, very beautiful, very Wisconsin type of food, and it's very intimate and small. It feels kind of like you're in New York, and that's sort of a very cool dining experience I think people wouldn't expect they would find here.
Okay, good. Happy holidays. Three good holiday choices there.
There you
I
go.
Guess. All right. Well, where would you take your parents if you want to take your parents somewhere special for a holiday dinner?
That's a good question, and I was thinking about it. I think if it incorporates a drive, that's kind of fun too, as long as the weather isn't bad. Hmm. There's a restaurant in Genesee Depot called the Union House, which is it's a great little place to go. You kind of feel like you're out in the boondocks, you know. And
if you don't want to be seen with your parents, you take them out of town.
Exactly. Right. And it's a restaurant that's actually near Ten Chimneys. If you're familiar with Ten Chimneys, mm-hmm. which is it was the home of Lunt and Fontanne. So you could actually go on a tour there, perhaps, if you wanted to. If you want to, you know, make it a whole day affair. But that would be, I think, a place that just feels kind of special. It's not a place you would maybe think about going to all the time.
Okay.
So that would be, I think that would be a fun place to take your parents.
Where is a good place to go to get away from the holidays? If you just want to go have dinner somewhere and just not be reminded, you know?
What about the corner tap?
Well.
No?
Okay,
I'm kidding.
We can go a little more, you know,
well,
nicer than that.
One year, I had some time between on Christmas Day before I needed to get to my family's for dinner. And a friend of mine, we had a ritual going that every Christmas we would go to a movie and then we would go to Elsa's and just have a drink at Elsa's. And I remember no one was in Elsa's except for a nun and a priest. And probably from St. John's Cathedral across the park. But I thought that was kind of fun. And it's not – I thought it was fun to just be at some place that you would not, again, think about going on Christmas. But I'm not saying necessarily you need to escape your family on Christmas Day. But that's sort of a fun place to go and just kind of hole up at the bar and have a Cosmo or have a glass of wine. Honestly, I think drinking is in order. When you want to escape your family – alcohol is needed, don't you think?
Sure.
I mean, think of the premise of almost every Christmas movie where there's a dysfunctional family.
All right. Well, I'm just wondering if there's a place to go where you'll find kind of a collection of people just, you know, trying to get away from their families
misfits?
For an evening. No, I wouldn't call them misfits. Just actually, I would call them sane, you know, if you're going to try to get away from your family for just a little bit, you know, if you're overwhelmed by it.
Wow. Again, I'm going with the bar, Dan.
Okay.
I'm going with the bar.
All right. Well, let's talk about cocktails. What do you think some good places to go if you just – holiday cocktails, sure. Or
holiday drinks, not necessarily, but alcoholic.
Sure, yeah.
Correct? Mm-hmm. Well, Bryant's is great to go to anytime, but during the holidays, they have a special, you know, series of holiday drinks.
Okay.
That, I mean, if you go to Bryant's, they could probably make hundreds of drinks, but mm-hmm. these are a little bit more wintry and holiday-ish. And I think people are, you know, are into that sort of thing. I think Bryant's is so, is totally fun, kitschy atmosphere.
Yeah.
So that's a place I think would
I think
be.
I think it's a national treasure, that place.
It totally is. It's sort of a lovable dive.
All right. Well, since we're talking about holiday drinks, what about holiday food? I'm not even sure what holiday food is. You know, the Dickens novels and, you know, Goose come to mind. But is there a place that has what you consider to be a good holiday food place? Like if you just want to go and have, I don't know what, turkey, ham? What do you have for the holidays? I have no idea.
Well, I mean, there are a number of restaurants that are going to be open on Christmas or Christmas Eve. And for instance, like some of the hotel restaurants where they're going to do, you know, turkey and mashed potatoes and gravy and ham. I don't know that – to me, this – I'm just going to tell you, it, just between the two of us, I don't think this is a great question because, I mean, you're either telling
you.
People to – well, no. Are you telling them to go to not have dinner at home on Christmas?
No, I'm just somewhere – if you want to get a taste of holiday food, it doesn't matter if it's on Christmas Day or between Christmas and New Year's. You know, you might want to get something that just has a holiday feel to it, the actual food itself. Where do you think a place that has that kind of food is?
Well, this is a dish that I would order all year round, but maybe it seems the most fitting during the holidays or at least during the winter at Jake's restaurant out in Pewaukee. They have really great duck and wild rice and like a cranberry, sort of a cranberry sauce with it. Mm. I don't know. To me, that's sort of, I guess, it feels like this time of year, you know, the cold in the air, the snow, the pine trees, everything sort of, all of it sort of feels like that kind of food that you might want to eat. That's sort of along those lines of the holiday feel. You know, maybe it's the time of year where someone wants to go for German food. They go to Mater's or they go to Karl Rasch's and they get, you know, they get sauerbraten or schnitzel or something along those lines. Again, that's not really technically holiday food, but maybe mm-hmm. that's when you think about a place like that that would serve food of that nature. But also you're probably going to go inside and see a decorated Christmas tree, a lot of Christmas decorations. And I think people like that feel of going in and seeing the twinkly lights and the wreaths and things like
right.
that.
Well, which makes me think, what's the best place to go then for to feel holiday nostalgia? Where do you think those places overlap, where you go to just feel like you did when you were a kid going out?
In a way. I mean, I think of the lobby at the Pfister, which always seems – is always very beautiful during the holidays. And this time of year also they're serving tea up on the 23rd floor just on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. And
at Blue?
At the Club Lounge, which is adjacent to Blue.
Okay.
So that's more of the library. But that, again, has that sort of Christmassy feel, again, sort of special tea, very cozy. I also think of a place that might have a fireplace, like County Clare. When you go into County Clare and you kind of congregate around the fireplace with a Guinness stout or something, that just feels like cozy.
Right. Okay. Good. Well, and then it's kind of hard to escape the holidays without desserts. So is any one or two or three places pop to mind that have really good desserts or even holiday-themed desserts?
Holiday-themed desserts.
Yeah.
Well, one of my favorite bakeries in town is Rocket Baby in Wauwatosa, right on North Avenue. Right now, I mean, they always have a lot of, you know, great pastries and things like that, but they're doing the Bûche de Noël, which is the Christmas log cake, which is a French thing. And you can order those. I know they're taking orders up through the holidays. They're also doing decorated Christmas cookies, which, you know, if you don't want to make your own or you want it to look really perfect, that would be a great place to do that. I like the cookies, the holiday cookies that they're doing at Beans and Barley in their deli, too. They have a nice selection of them. Again, you could put together a box, take them to go and bring them with you. I do not know anyone who is doing fruitcake. I don't know that I want to. You can go to Sendix and find Stullen, which, oddly enough, one of my brothers loves Stullen. It is the rest of us just, like, avoid it, like the plague. It's not anything you want to
eat. What is it?
It's a yeast bread that has candied fruit in it and nuts, and then it has a glaze on top. But I think it's the candied fruit that turns me off. I just have never liked candied fruit. But I think that Rocket Baby would be a really fun place. They also make a Kringle on certain days of the week, their version of a Kringle, which would be a really, I think, a fun thing to bring to a holiday brunch or to have just in the morning for yourself with a cup of coffee.
All right. Well, I hope you have a good holiday. We'll talk to you next year.
Thank you. You too.
All right.
Ann Christensen is dining critic and senior editor at Milwaukee Magazine and our regular dining contributor. She talked about holiday season dining with Dan Harmon. One last break, and then an essayist relates his first experience as a deer hunter in Wisconsin. This is Lake Effect for WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Finally today, the gun season for hunting deer is over in Wisconsin. The bow season continues. This year marked the first time Lake Effect essayist Ed Makowski actually took part in the deer hunt.
I can't remember the first time I wanted to hunt. No one in my family hunted. And aside from archery at Boy Scout camp, I didn't grow up with firearms. My neighbor friend had a dad who hunted. Old enough to know better than invite myself, but young enough to be precocious, I asked lots of questions, hoping they'd bring me along. In my mid-20s, I took hunter safety class and started asking around if anyone I knew hunted. I learned the pursuit tends to be a very family-centered activity, and just like when I was a kid, it can be hard to find somebody to invite you to learn. Being an absolute novice, I decided I shouldn't hunt on public land until I'd learned something about the practice. If somebody in conversation mentioned hunting, I'd say, I'd taken my gun and bow certification and was eager to learn. The sound of crickets usually followed, and I wouldn't push the matter. The desire to kill an animal for sport never interested me. Cable television shows where thrill hunters pursue the largest pair of antlers in an orgiastic frenzy leaves me dumbfounded. I wanted to know where my food comes from. As a lifelong consumer of meat, I felt a sense of duty to know something about the process. The fact that I ate meat, which came from some place, raised by some stranger, and butchered by other people who I'd never know anything about, produced a subtle shame in me. I wondered that if I couldn't stomach the realities of killing an animal to eat it, maybe I should subscribe to a meat-free diet. Fast forward to this autumn. I was at a cookout, and my friend Mike mentioned land his family owns. I asked if they hunted on it, and if I could join. He said, sure. The last Sunday of gun season, it turned out I was at the land by myself. Mike's family and friends harvested 4 deer throughout the 11-day gun season. Around 2:30, I was finishing up an email on my smartphone when I heard rustling sounds in front of me. I was sitting in front of an oak tree surrounded by mowed grass. About 100 paces in front of the oak tree, there's 30 yards of tall prairie grasses. Beyond the prairie, there's a cornfield about the size of a basketball court. Past the corn is all forest. I looked up and saw the hind end of a deer scuttling low through the tall grasses. I picked up the gun, a shotgun which another friend had loaned me. But after standing, I couldn't find the deer. Slowly, I stalked through the grass for a few minutes, then stood at the ready, all senses hyper-engaged. Where could the deer have gone? I just saw it right in front of me. Thinking it may have gotten out of the grass, I turned into the corn and searched there for a few minutes. Oh, yeah. Click off the gun safety in case you see the deer. I walked back out of the corn and decided to zigzag slowly through the prairie. For a person who didn't grow up with guns, 10 minutes is a long time to hold that thing out in front of you. Then suddenly, as I stepped back toward the oak tree, right in front of me, 10 or 15 feet away, sat a 6-point buck. Well, here the two of us are, enjoying the first Sunday in December. I remembered people saying not to aim for the head because it's a small target. The smarter shot is the heart and lungs, which are above and behind the front leg. With the animal in repose, I debated, but not for long because it stood up to run. I fired once, striking the deer's left side as he sprinted toward the cornfield, and knowing I was alone on the property, I emptied the gun in his direction. After the deer entered the cornfield, I paused a moment, considering what to do next. The shots echoed throughout Sheboygan County, and a mild ring in my ears now disrupted the late fall wind. I reloaded the Remington 870 while walking toward the corn. For a moment, I stood outside, trying to decide if I should follow the animal right away. Had it run straight through the corn? What if I didn't see the deer and got kicked? What if I ended up gored by the antlers? What a lame headline. First-time hunter dies with punctured liver 10 feet from the deer he shot. I raised the gun and again slowly waded into the cornfield, each papery corn husk making contact with my elbows and knees, and a medium-sized bird flapping in the southwest. Halfway into the cornfield, I found the deer, again, looking with a straight stillness right at me. I fired a single shot to the head and stayed back for a couple minutes, allowing the animal a respectful space in the last moments of his life. Immediately, I tried to remember all the things they told us to do in hunter safety class. Engage the safety on your gun. Affix a tag to the antlers. Hang something orange above yourself so you're visible. I called my friend's dad, Larry, the owner of the land. Larry taught his kids how to hunt when they were little. "Well, Larry," I said, "I got a deer. What now?" He chuckled and said he'd be out soon to give me a hand. The cornfield was muddy, so I pulled the deer up through the cornfield, across the prairie grasses, and up near the oak tree. While dragging backward, I thought, these antlers are really convenient handles. Larry showed up and was excited as we understated Wisconsinites get. "Wow, first year out, you got a deer. Some people go years without even seeing one. Did you bring a knife?" I wanted to learn about how an animal gets turned into meat, and I sure got what I asked for. Field dressing is the polite way to reference removing an animal's internal organs. Let's just say it's an intimate and involved process, and there's plenty of work to be done. And it happens in the field under the waning sunlight of a December afternoon before the carcass arrives at the butcher. Afterwards, I felt grateful for the experience. Will I hunt again? Hunting, at its very least, is a walk in the woods listening to the birds talk to one another. Kneeling next to the dead deer, I tried to assess my feelings at that moment. Initially, I felt a little rude, pulling the deer's body around through the cornfield. I couldn't believe how long his legs were and how quickly he ran away with a bullet lodged in his chest. But beyond that, I was surprised at how natural and correct the whole experience felt. I was left with a nodding sense of, yes, this is how this works. This is how life has always worked. This feels natural and correct. I'm right where I should be.
Lake Effect essayist Ed Makowski lives and writes in Milwaukee. That's the Monday edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, for Christmas Eve Day, the first of several best-of editions of Lake Effect, we'll revisit interviews with some nationally known authors, from Kate Atkinson to Jen Lancaster. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.